Cool. Hi, this is Jan Münter. I've known Jan for 16, 17, a long time ago. Jan is awesome. He has done awesome, awesome, awesome security things. He has not spoken about them many times. I had to twist his arm a little bit to get him here. And I'm very, very excited to get him to talk about Crushed by the Wheels of Industry. Please give a warm welcome to Jan Münter.
Cheers. First of all, I have to say, I've done a lot of corporate shit over the last 3 years, as just about everybody did. I have to say, it's really good to see a bunch of hackers again. So, hello, hello. And I hope I have some interesting things for you to do, to look at today. I want to talk about industrial security a little bit. Specifically about the semiconductor industry. The reason why I've picked this topic is I work in this area, right? And I actually got thrown into this by chance. Really, you know, bushy-tailed, bright-eyed. Essentially, my background, kind of like Ilya, is software security. I've been doing for product security for a very long time. That's also how I landed in this industry, actually. And then at some point, sort of by chance, I just looked around and sort of saw the sorry state that the actual industrial security in this area is in. And so, you know, valiantly, I made it my task to try and make things a little better, at least for my employer. And I looked around and saw that there are some also some very essential, very practical and actually very low level problems with the products that some vendors in this area are selling and with the way things are typically run. And I started looking at the machinery per se, you know, like the way do these things, like scanning them, looking at the firmware, looking at the software, etc. And there were some very interesting takeaways there. First of all, this talk is pretty much threefold. The first stage here is I'm going to do a little bit like, you know, I don't know how many Germans are in the audience today, but maybe you know the program Die Sendung mit der Maus, right? So it's a little presentation of how things are made. Before I got thrown into this industry, I had absolutely no fucking clue whatsoever how semiconductors are made. And that's going to be the first stage. Second stage is going to be, I just show you a couple of things that I stumbled across in this area and why I think they're problematic. And the third brief but important stage is going to be talking a little bit about the things that I think we can do better and what is needed to get to a better result. The semiconductor production really has a very high level of automation for very good reasons. A lot of the steps are so intricate and so delicate in the way they have to be executed that humans are incapable of doing. So you basically have a lot of industrial robots doing some very, very intricate tasks. Of course, all of these machines need to be controlled somehow. And this is exactly, as you would think, this is exactly the area where things get problematic, but we'll get to it. One other factor that comes into play is that this is a very limited playing field. I've seen that during the time when I was a security consultant, that especially in the areas where you have a very limited market, very limited amount of actors, and typically also in an industry that doesn't have a lot of consumer exposure, security is really never taken into consideration from the beginning. No, the market pressure usually has to build up from the customers, and that is something that hasn't been there for a very long time. So let's talk about how the semiconductors are made. Again, I had no clue. It was very fascinating for me to see. I want to clue you in a little. Let's walk through the process. First stage, the base material. those are the wafers. Those are essentially silicon disks from size 2 inch, which you can see down there, to the biggest size that is typically being processed is 8 inches. And those are silicon disks about a millimeter strong that come as base material to the factories from specific vendors that make. Yeah? One of the things that's maybe interesting to know is that the size of the wafer that can be processed in a factory really has a big influence on the yield of the factory. How many things can be processed in parallel, and how many semiconductors you can churn out in a certain time frame. So this is really, if you have a factory that is capable of processing 8-inch wafers, you're really, you know, on the cutting edge of it. Next thing, the wafers are processed in lots. Everything is handled in lots. The German word for this is los. So basically, if a customer orders a certain amount of semiconductors, those will be processed per order, and the order, when it goes into execution, when it goes into fabrication, turns into a lot. And these lots are then the logical units in which the processing is being handled. The physical handling of these things in the production environment is handled with these so-called SMIF parts. SMIF stands for Standards Mechanical Interface. Why are these needed? Well, we're talking about a highly clean environment, a super clean, super pristine environment, cleaner than a 12-year-old Mormon. It's an environment in which everybody, you know, has to dress up in these clean room clothes, and the environment has to be so clean that the wafers themselves must never really actually be handled by humans. Now you ask yourself, maybe, well, then how do they get from the delivery into the SMIF pods? That is actually also done by machines. They have these loading stations where they put the raw material in, essentially press a button and say, like, load 10 of these wafers into a SMIF part. And then the SMIF parts carry the names and the numbers of the lots, and then these things get transported. And the actual machines that then further process the wafers unload the wafers from the SMIF parts. You put them in there, and a little robot goes, grabs the wafer, and then does whatever function step is being needed. Yeah? So this is how this goes. The physical transport of the SMIF parts is usually actually done by humans. That's why you have a red handle there. No? But there are also factories where some of the transport is actually done by conveyor belts. Yeah? The first important step is actually photolithography. So I don't know if any of you has ever made a PCB board themselves. If you've done this, one of the ways of doing it is to actually, you know, have some photosensitive material on the board, and you put some light on it with a mask. Yeah? And this is essentially also what you do in industrial semiconductor production, a little bit more intricate. The wafers are, of course, first cleaned and passivized. Passivized means they are prepared in such a way that they are less reactive, less chemically reactive, right? And the lithography process usually involves either a mask or lens projector. Yeah? So you can really imagine this like, you know, maybe at home your parents still have a slide projector, right? So it, essentially it works the same way, only a slide projector will of course magnify the picture. In semiconductor production, you minify the picture. You make it smaller what you project onto the wafer. And the structures that you can optically create with this are extremely small, like up to a nanometer. So this is really, this is how the initial structure is being brought onto the wafer. So you apply something that is called photoresist, which is, you know, light-resistant material that is being brought onto the wafer by spin coating. What is spin coating? Basically, you spin the wafer like a DJ, you know, only a machine and not so super fast. Then you put some of the liquid in the middle, and it spreads out. You know? So this is, that is spin coating. Then you expose it to light. This is what exact light, what light frequencies. This has to be, of course, depends upon the exact material, but it's usually ultraviolet. Then after the exposure, you apply a developer. You know, like photo development in your mad uncle's photo lab, right? This is just one example of such a machine here from a vendor called EUV. Those machines, like this is, you know, these are industrial processes with big ass machines that, you know, machine like this is going to run you somewhere north of 1.5 million euros. Then next up, doping. Not this guy. Actual material, no, seriously. What this is it's the process in which the semiconductors are ionized. Yeah? So you guys are all nerds. You know that, you know, semiconductors, transistors, and so forth all have, you know, either P or N doping, right? And this is how this is done, through actual ionization, through which material is then either turned into something that accepts electrons or donates electrons. And this is done, that is actually something that is kind of sort of important to know with boron, phosphorus, or arsenic. And also, quite a few of the substances that are being handled here are really safety sensitive. And when you think of the fact that the machines that handle them are not so super secure, that is actually a little touchy. Right, then the next step is etching. That is where the surface of the wafer is then etched. Yeah? So again, if any of you has ever made a PCB board, you know this step. This is how the stuff that has not been exposed to light then gets etched away, so that only the structures that you need for the actual semiconductor logical structure remain there. Exactly, only the areas in which the photoresist has been fixated by the developer remain. The rest gets taken away. Afterwards, it also gets cleaned, usually with like a scrubbing thingy. I forgot the name of that, but it's that is another intricate process. You have different methods of etching. You can do dry etching, wet etching, or plasma etching. Dry etching with stuff like potassium hydroxide. Wet etching, which is most common that at least I've seen, is done with hydrofluoric acid, but there's also plasma etching where, you know, you have a plasmified gas that does the etching, for instance, carbon tetrachloride. Yeah, the next step is one that I find extremely fascinating in technology, that is deposition and epitaxy. So this is basically where the actual conductive structures that come onto the die are being formed. How are these substances deposited? There are several ways through which you can do this. Chemical vapor deposition, as the name implies, you know, it's a vapor, which is directed at the structures that have been exposed before, atomic layer deposition, physical vapor deposition, and the most fascinating one, and also the one that is most prevalent nowadays in nanotechnology, that is the molecular beam epitaxy, which is an extremely intricate process. And the machines that that execute this process, they work with so-called recipes, kind of like your Thermomix at home. They basically have a recipe that says, apply this here for this amount of time, apply that here for that amount of time. And that kind of stuff is really extremely intricate, and also a lot of, it's very research intense, very research and development intense. And so this is one of the areas where typically most semiconductor producers are also really sensitive about their intellectual property. Yeah? So the process per se is fascinating, because with the molecular beam epitaxy, where you create crystalline structures through a molecular beam, so really like with a beam at the molecular level, you can apply extremely thin structures. Like the picture I have here is one atom layer thick, one atom layer thick layer of silver on palladium. Yeah? So that is the level of detail that we talk about here. So this probably also explains why this method is specifically the one that is most frequently used in the nanotechnology. That actually requires a very, very, very pure vacuum. So there must be almost no, air molecules left in the processing, because the substances are, it's all very, very, very tiny and very, very targeted. So if there's anything in the way, the processing gets corrupted. So this is a really intricate stuff. Yeah. Next up, testing. Now, we all know about testing, but testing in the semiconductor industry is a little bit different, because it actually demarks the level of quality that you can produce. So through testing, you can prove to yourself that you actually reach the levels of production quality that you set for yourself, and also that you promise to your customers. So testing is super duper important. And if a tester fails, or during a testing process, you notice that there's something wrong with the tester, you just have to repeat it all again. There's absolutely no way anything can ever be shipped without having been properly tested. How is this done? Well, basically, there are some expectations when you look at a semiconductor die, such as you connect measure point one with measure point two, and if you send a current through it, there's a certain value that you expect. How is this being done? In probing testing, this is done with like very little gold wires that are being put onto the die, and that is then measured. There are also other things that are being done, such as visual inspection with microscopes. And again, this is to a high level actually automated through pattern recognition. So this is also kind of fascinating. They take the wafer, put it under the microscope, expect a certain pattern, and if it deviates from that, really with like the usual Fourier transform pattern recognition stuff, it passes, and if it's outside the expected parameters, it gets alerted as fucked up batch, bad yield, bad person, bad horsey. Then the next step is die preparation. What is being done here is, of course, you still have the prepared circuits on the wafer. And if you have an IC in your hand, you know there's a step in between somewhere, right? So the wafer, first of all, gets mounted on the material that backs it up. And then the wafer gets diced, like it gets cut, like a piece of chocolate. And this is actually being done with very, very tiny saws, like diamond tools. Huh? And because you still need to pull this very tiny bandsaw through the wafer, when the wafer is created, when the wafer is laid out with the lithography, they leave a little space in between the dies, like around 100 nanometers, so that the saw can cut through, you know? So they dice it, and then you have the little piece. And then from there, it goes into packaging. So then you have the dies, right? The little thingies, and those can then be packaged. They are usually put together into resin, so basically plastic, with wires sticking out that connect to the connection points of the die, and then you have a semiconductor that is ready for shipping. You can, of course, also have more complicated structures inside the package. There's no need to only have one die in there. You can stack them, which is, maybe you've seen the presentations by Chris Tarnowski or something, right? So when they take acid to move layer by layer through a semiconductor, or through a chip, then you see those have been stacked in production. Huh? This is how that is. So that is how you end up with the well-known chips. Huh? So that was the Sendung mit der Maus part. Just a quick rundown as of how semiconductors are created. Now I want to talk about how the situation actually looks in the industry when we talk about cyber. Huh? A lot in this manufacturing process is automated, computerized. All the machines are smartly controlled. And as we all know, if it's smart, it can be hacked. Naturally, this is an attack surface that attracts a certain amount of people. There really are two main risks that we're dealing with in the industry. One is ransomware. The other is industrial espionage. When we talk about ransomware, this really has massively bumped up in this specific area. And as a matter of fact, I don't know how much this has been shared in the media, actually. But specifically, the European manufacturing industry has been in the focus of ransomware operators lately. Because in manufacturing, of course, if you encrypt the actual machines that control the manufacturing, nobody can produce it. No? And when we look at our factories, one site that I'm specifically thinking about, if that's down for a day, that's like a loss of around between 25 and 50 million, just per day. And so, of course, the economic pressure is extremely high if you hijack the machines of someone in the production. Secondly, industrial espionage. I mentioned already that the epitaxy, for instance, is an area in which the recipes that are being used there are really highly demanded intellectual property. The situation has changed also dramatically through the fact that the Americans have placed this, embargo on Chinese companies, so that nobody with American citizenship can work for a Chinese semiconductor producer. So the interest of certain also state actors to get more insight into how certain things are made has definitely bumped up. And that has also definitely reflected in the number and type of attacks that we've and yes, stuff happens. Like the colleagues from X-Fab, which is a German semiconductor producer, have been hit by ransomware. They were completely out of the picture for several weeks. It hurt them really, really, really bad. So this stuff does happen, and it really does hurt. Of course, not everything makes it to the public. But yeah. So let's talk about the systems a little. A lot of this is also stuff that I just had to learn from scratch, because you never hear about these systems anywhere else. The central system that controls the environment in a manufacturing plant is the manufacturing execution system, called MES. These systems are basically they reach out to other parts, other systems. We say like level one, level zero. That doesn't matter, but to other systems within the enterprise, especially in enterprise resource planning. So very often, you know, that's your dreadful SAP system. And then one of the other things that they also do is they connect to the equipment. Yeah? Because the equipment will report to them, yes, I have processed this. I have processed this lot. Sometimes it depends on the equipment and the implementation there, but sometimes the MES actually also physically controls the equipment. As in, it starts an execution, it halts an execution, and so forth. But in any case, there will be data streams in terms of reporting, monitoring, and so forth. So basically, the MES talks to enterprise resource planning on the one end, and the actors on the other end. And these can be, you know, your typical PLCs, like the Siemens Step 7 stuff, God knows what, and a lot of the SCADA stuff, and or distributed control systems. So, you know, where the control is actually distributed through different instances in a plant. Some common systems, Siemens is big in the market with Symantec IT MES, Rockwell Automation. You actually do see that a lot, that uses Modbus on the control end. Schneider is a big name, Honeywell is big. General Electric, as always, they're in the market. And there are many niche manufacturers. So many names who you will have never heard. And the only thing they do is MES for a certain niche industry. And I can definitely tell you, these niches, where there's no light, scary things grow. MES attack surface. A lot of this should be obvious. You know, of course, they need to be networked, and of course, they need to interact with other systems. The other systems also need to call into the MES. So a lot of them expose services through SOAP, yes, through SOAP, through REST, through Java Remote Method Invocation, through .NET Windows Communication Framework services. And very often, you would be surprised, very often there is no authentication. In general, the assumption is if you're in the production environment, in the physical production environment, you're in safe territory. You know, the perimeter paradigm is alive and kicking in the semiconductor industry. Very often, all of them that I've seen use a relational database as a backend, usually with hard-coded credentials. You can't even change them. Or if you're lucky, they're only default credentials, which also everybody leaves as they are. Plain text communication, of course, nobody uses the encryption capabilities that you have to license extra in the case of Oracle. It's a pain in MS SQL, they use like the SQL-based authentication instead of Windows authentication. It's horrible. Equipment integration. So basically the way the MES talks to the equipment. So I was in this call, I was new in the area, and people were talking and they were blah, 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 sex gem. And I was like, what? It's a common semi-standard, we get to semi, but I was like, sex? Gem? I had no clue what the hell they were talking. Has any of you ever heard of sex gem? No. A protocol that was completely unknown to me. What this is it actually is a combination of things. SEX, S-E-C-S, is the actual protocol. It's defined by an association called SEMI, S-E-M-I, which is the biggest industry association in the semiconductor industry. And basically, they specified this protocol as the way all equipment in the industry can be controlled. Originally, the GM standard only says these are the things that a piece of equipment must support. So these are the things that it must be able to do through this protocol. And the GEM standard, for example, says you need to have a state model, you need to have a way of reflecting the processing states and so forth. Remote control is optional, but a lot of them have chosen to implement it. Again, you see the list here. There's actually the standards. That's probably one of the reasons why you've never heard of this. The standards are proprietary to SEMI. You know, so if you want to have access to them, it costs you $150 a pop. So, and they get really hissy fits if you distribute it. So, one of the biggest, one of the best outlines of these standards that I've seen that are public is linked here. Edge Integration did this. Thanks, guys, from Edge Integration, whoever you are. The SEX protocol itself is supposed to be like a lingua franca for the equipment integration, kind of like Esperanto for machines, only more successful. the SEX 1 is really like a simple request reply standard. SEMI 2 is a standard for block-based messaging, and that is also the one that has then been turned into a network protocol. When we say protocol here, this is also something that really shines through. These are people who have been previously only been working with direct connections, you know, with like electric leads that connect things in order to process something. So the security challenges that arise through the fact that you actually connect things to a network are super surprising to them. So the protocols themselves were originally designed to be transported over a serial link, over RS-232. And so at some point they said, like, hey, let's make this faster and use this you know, modern hype standard Ethernet. And so they created a protocol that is called HSMS, high-speed messaging, high-speed SEX message service, semi-standard number E37. Semi is big, by the way. Around 250,000 members. Nobody has ever heard of that crazy association outside of the semiconductor. Anyway, HSMS. What is this? It's, again, SEX2 over TCP/IP. It uses TCP port 5000, and nobody tells you that. Like, really, you read through all the standards, and nowhere does it tell you, like, what fucking port does it use, you know? So you really have to, like, look for it in other places and or just scan the damn things, you know? But in any case, at some point, you find it out. Actually, Wireshark can decode it, you know? They probably read the standard from Edge. In any case, it's relatively simple in structure. The packets are, well, sort of as you would expect. Of course, there's a length field. I see the glint in Ilya's eyes. There's a message header, and then there's the message text in which the actual gem commands are inside there. Once more, SEX is the protocol. Gem is the standard, what the machines are supposed to do. Yeah? Okay. In any case, the A in SEXGEM stands for identification, authentication, and authorization. It's simply not there. Like, the assumption is, if you have connectivity, you can talk to it. Be my guest. There are absolutely zero security features. There's really an assumption of a secured point-to-point environment. Really, like, they connect it to a network and expect it to be just as secure as through. There's a huge number of implementation errors, but once you start looking at the stacks, really, I just did some very basic parsing, just, you know, for really like half an hour Python, you know, and everything crumbles. Really, all the implementation errors that you can guess, you know, like off-bound reads just through making the size field bigger. Of course, there are integer overflows because they add the header links to the length field, then you have that overflowing. So they allocate a smaller space than the actual payload that is later copied. Lots and lots and lots of that stuff. Yeah? Classical buffer overflows, integer overflows, it's all there. And usually, you know, everybody and their dog must implement this in C or C++. Huh? Yeah, a little bit more about the equipment security itself. It's a very juicy area. To be truthful with you, every single piece of equipment that I've looked at was hackable. Some more blatantly, some less blatantly, but some of it was really, you know, like shooting fish in a barrel. You have to keep in mind, the thing that makes this possible for the most part is the fact that this equipment has an extremely long lifetime. When you buy a machine for $1 million, $2 million, $3 million, of course you want to keep them around a little longer than you know, your average Windows laptop. And so they have lifetimes between 10 and 25, easily. I've seen one machine that was running on MS-DOS 2.0, and it had a network stack. lots of equipment based on completely unmaintained operating systems. Windows XP is frequent, Windows 7 is frequent, ancient Unix derivatives. This brings a tear to this old man's eyes. Yeah, you'll see. Manufacturers, again, deliver the systems as they are and refuse to provide support unless the software is operated in the exact way that they've delivered it. No? So that really is a problem. Maybe if some of you have worked in the medical field, it's very similar to that. No, it gets certified in a certain state, and only the vendor is allowed. If you do it yourself, you lose support and you're screwed. No? A lot of hard-coded credentials. Really, hard-coded, of course, is the worst-case scenario, but very often it's at least default credentials, which nobody ever changed. A lot of services that run completely without any authentication whatsoever. Again, the assumption, it's as safe as an RS-232 link. And they very commonly use disastrous protocols such as VNC or Telnet. No, with VNC, it's really like if you ask them to use something else, like X forwarding over SSH or something, they say not supported. No? And then even there, it's the most horrible versions of VNC with where you don't even have encrypted communication, no SSL and stuff. So yeah, let's look at some, right? A good example. So I was scanning around. I saw this here. Yeah, I know it was Christmas, right? But still, this is another Christmas tree right there for you. And I was like, oh, I know this. This is a Unix system. And you know, again, this brought a tear to this. I'm working on my Unix beard, right? And so this made me scratch it. What was this? Yeah, I'll show you a little bit. You know, of course it was an IRIX system. IRIX 6.2. I don't know, who here remembers IRIX at all? Lovely, I love you guys. In any case, this is a version of IRIX that has default users that can log in without any password. As you can see, you know, I'm using the easy setup user here there. I haven't provided a password, it just locked me straight in. Yeah? And back in those days, early system 5 days, you didn't have shadow passwords. No? So the etc passwd, yes, I've X'd it out now here. Pardon me, it was one of our own systems, right? But it contained the password hash. You know, well, actually, not even a hash. Of course, it's classical DES, you know, with a little salt. Yeah, this was from a vendor called Insight that made visual inspection equipment automated. Yeah, this is a little Metasploit screenshot here. There, pardon me. Don't get too excited, the 192.168.120, that was me. But the kithopper, that's username and password, right? And this is from a vendor called Keithley, and they also do inspection and testing equipment. And how did I find this? And no, I didn't reverse the firmware or anything, I ran Finger. Yeah. So then I had the username. I tried the username as password, bam. Yeah. So, and of course, I then tried it against the rest of the equipment and I found plenty of lockers. When you Google it, Keith, Keith Opper, you find it. You know, it's documented. It's default credentials are la la la. Nobody ever changes. Just to show you how things look, you know, I told you VNC is very common, and they expose these interfaces to this here was a recipe testing. It gives you these are the kind of interfaces that are then exposed via VNC. When I told you VNC is so, sometimes you find them without any authentication at all. Oh, like is so very common in the SCADA world, or very creative, substantially difficult passwords such as that. Another thing here, I told you hard-coded credentials are very common, right? This here is from a yield management system, which basically, yeah, It measures the yield that you're currently outputting, and it allows you to locate failures and to optimize your yield, right? And so what these guys did was they have a mechanism in place, they only have one central technical database user, which is used from every client and that connects to the remote system. And all the user-specific credentials and authentication authorization are then done within the database. You know? Of course, when you extract the credentials for this administrative technical user, everything is yours. You know? And it wasn't difficult to find. I mean, come on, this was some .NET code. I think it took like half an hour to find. And as a matter of fact, and you don't even have to be so hardcore. You know, the same credentials are also stored in the client in a config file, which is encrypted with an extremely advanced encryption standard, which I'm sure you've never heard of. It's called Base64. Yeah, this is another of these VNC interfaces. Here you can also see the optical inspection with a microscope. That's why I thought this might be interesting for you guys to look at. And this one I added because I found it cute that it says prober is this is a prober, and also for testing the probing. Prober is under remote control. So this thing, for instance, it has the gem features for remote control, and they're active. So this thing is completely remotely controlled by the MES. Another, I just thought I'd add some eye candy for you guys because we're all nerds and we love high tech. Here you can see some needles on a die. Yeah, there's plenty of vulnerabilities in the custom software that you see there. Niche manufacturers with little exposure to security requirements. Actually, when you talk to them about this, you know, and about the fact that the perimeter security paradigm has been dead for at least 20 years, you know, and you tell them, you know, this can be attacked also. This is not just a safety issue, it's also a security issue. Somebody might actually try and do something with it. They go like, you may have a point there. No? So really like Clint Eastwood in Dirty Harry, squinting their eyes, and it slowly trickles in. But a lot of these people, you can definitely tell that nobody has raised security requirements to them before. No? I was talking about that yield management system already. At times, you know, these systems expose crucial intellectual property. No? And so if this is so easily reachable, of course, it makes a significant problem for the companies. No? Typically, you have no dedicated security. So it's really difficult to find somebody who even has the capability to change things. There are some companies who have heard the wake-up calls, but they're rare. I'll talk about that. More vulnerabilities. You see a lot of Java software. And of course, there, what you can do is just decompile it, you know. And one thing that is very frequently used, I mentioned that in the MES area already, is you have a lot of JRMI services. And to the vendor's defense, even in the Java documentation where you have the JRMI examples, there is no authentication. Well, and as a matter of fact, what they do is they say you could implement the authentication verification on the server side. You could do that, but it would put too much of a load on the server, so you do it on the client side. Yeah, and of course, you know, you also have a lot of serialization issues, so it's like putting fish in a barrel. Of course. Yeah, exactly. So what do we do with this? An outlook into the future. Really, the only chance that you have is you have to build a walled garden. No? Yes, everybody and their son, including me, hates the perimeter paradigm, but you have no other. The equipment cannot be patched. It is terribly insecure. It will remain terribly insecure for the years to come. The only chance that you have is you put it Snake Plissken, Escape from New York. You put it like behind walls and let it just be mayhem within there. You know? And really what you have to do is you have to define the data exchange points, what goes in, what goes out. And you only allow that. And what you cannot control, you have to monitor. If anything out of the ordinary happens, you have to throw big ass alerts. You know? That is really the only approach that can realistically work. And one of the things that I'm currently really trying to do, I'm trying to do some advocacy with the manufacturers and software vendors. I understand that this has simply not been a priority for them just because their customers have not raised these points before until the ransomware pandemic. And really, I think this wake-up call needs to happen. And I do my very best to talk to people and make them aware that these are problems. You know? I really find that when you talk to people, they have been caring about safety for a very, very long time, as in the things must keep running. And also, a lot of these things are physically dangerous. You know, I was mentioning boron, I was mentioning arsenic, you know. It's really, if something that happens, never mind the fact that some of this is also mechanically dangerous to the people who work there. You know? So they're very sensitive about this. And when you, raise the fact that somebody may be intentionally doing these things, they're shocked. You know? Like a lot of them are really like, oh my God, I haven't thought about it. And I really think this is trickling in relatively slowly but steadily. Now also because they get more warnings from others. And this doesn't only apply to the people who build the software, who build the machines, but also to the people who operate them. I can definitely tell that from our folks that a lot of them have the general attitude that this is behind the firewall, it's fine. And so that is also something. Some have taken action. I just want to give a brief shout out to the people from National Instruments. That is a big vendor in the area. And yes, there are also some stuff, some things that are less than ideal and so forth, but at least they've done some stuff. You know, at least their default configuration already has encryption activated, you know? And stuff like this. And they have security advisories, they have a security contact. So some people are really doing this. Huh? So a brief shout out to them. More of that, please. I would like to see more of that from other vendors working on this. And yeah, thanks for listening to me rant. That was it. But that was enjoyable. Any questions? Yeah. How do we do this? Do we have an angel? Or?
So, speaking from the position of an analog IC designer, I am kind of wondering whether the nice person who laughed at all these obsolete softwares and ignorance of the layers software layer stack is part of holding the hardware guys hostage by just the wantonly creating into existence a whole stack of abstraction layers, which is so inscrutable that as an analog designer who's trained to deal with an absolute minimum of state space, is confronted with this layer that used to be RS-232. Now you have this whole layer stack. Now you have this whole Parkinson-esque bureaucracy of abstraction layers and the Parkinson-esque bureaucracy of people and their managers who are supposed to be in charge, and nobody knows what's going on completely. So could the solution be to say that by putting this software stack into position and laughing at all the people who don't know it? Is the existence of that unnecessary complexity the ransomware attack, and should it be solved by just abolishing all you guys?
It's a two-edged sword, you know? Like the whole standardization and the whole abstraction, of course, also brings about possibilities that you haven't had before, you know? Otherwise, the people wouldn't have done it in terms of, you know, churn rate, yield rate, and so forth. And the whole integration, it does make things easier for the operators, for instance. I mean, if you just look at the increase in yield, there's definitely, you know, an economic point to be made. But in general, I of course fully agree with you that there's a lot of unnecessary complexity in this, you know.
As an illustrious colleague of you once pointed out, nearly everything that matters is a side effect, and yeah. And the whole this whole stack is so full of side effects, yeah. That that's the problem.
No, I mean, in generally, I could not agree more. You know, of course, there's a lot of unnecessary complexity in this, and. You know, as another illustrious colleague of mine said, if it's smart, it can be hacked. So as soon as you have something that is Turing complete, you must assume that there's the possibility to manipulate it. And I just think the awareness for that must at least be there. And that is something that we're not even at.
Yes, you said about the importance of the safety of the information, of the receipts, of the
yeah,
the process.
Recipes.
So I would suggest there is something like supply chain or service chain, what is very interesting from a standpoint of an attacker. So what are your measures to improve or reduce the risk that somebody who makes some remote to get access to the information on your production setup?
Yeah, I have to tell you the things I do for love, right? It's really, a lot of the things that we're talking about here are super basic. In the access restriction in the first place, you would be shocked to see how accessible critical data sometimes is. I was speaking about old school Unix vulnerabilities. You see NFS shares, which are shared to slash, you know, and stuff like that. So just applying access controls carefully, because it's all in production, you know, step by step. That is really the first thing that you do. And then I was speaking about monitoring. You know, one of the things that I, for instance, have set up in strategically important places is I've placed canaries. I don't know if you know these things, but canary tokens, you know, basically that data that if somebody uses them, if somebody opens them, if somebody, like for instance, an SSH key that you put somewhere, or Azure token, AWS token, if somebody uses it, an alarm gets triggered. And so these are things that would normally not get used by anybody, but an attacker who looks around the system will jump on it. You know? And I've also placed some canary systems in strategically important networks, so that when somebody scans around and probes around and tries passwords, I know it. You know? Really, more you cannot do. You are dependent on the software being what it is. Yeah?
Well, I think we're out of time at this point.
Oh, yeah, all right. I'm sorry.
But I mean, Jan's available.
I'm here in any case, right? So if you want to chat.
Was really room.
Also, if anyone else is from the industry, you know, I would love to chat.
Well, thank you so much. I very much appreciate this.
Yeah.